Hello, it's great to be back with you on the True Travel Podcast, which I can't believe is now in season 3. So welcome back if you have been listening already, and welcome to those of you who are new to the podcast. I hope you are going to enjoy it. I've got some more great guests with their unique tales of adventure lined up for you this season. We'll be hearing about how to travel the world without setting foot on a plane, taking on a major expedition through the Amazon and having a flesh-eating parasite to show for it, the first artist to compose an entire album on a cross-country train, and exploring far-flung places with 3 kids in tow. Kicking things off with me this week, though, is the BBC travel show's Carmen Roberts. Born in Singapore, Carmen has lived in Australia, Japan, and the UK, and visited more than 80 countries. She's here to reminisce and take us behind the cameras on some of her most memorable assignments, which include tourism in the secretive North Korea, what it was like to report from Phuket in the wake of the 2004 tsunami, and discovering the alternative Machu Picchu in Peru. If you enjoy this podcast, make sure you're subscribed wherever you get your podcasts from, and it would mean an awful lot to me if you could leave behind a review and pass it on to a friend as well. You can see more from the podcast and its guests on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Just search for the True Travel Podcast. Hi, Carmen. Thanks for joining me on the True Travel Podcast. You've just returned from Chile, haven't you?
Yes.
Which I believe has taken you over 2 days to get home and was 2 years in the making. So altogether, it's been quite a long slog, hasn't it? Are you recovered now?
Yes, I can't believe we actually made it. I can't believe we actually got there. It was crazy because this trip was first mooted back in, 2019, before the pandemic. And it was actually cancelled the first time because there was social unrest in Chile. So, people were demonstrating on the streets. So then that the trip got cancelled or postponed. And then, of course, COVID happened and it got postponed twice because of COVID. And then we were meant to go in January 2022. And I got COVID, rather annoyingly. I was devastated. You know, I just couldn't believe. I thought, right, this is it. This trip's never going to happen now. And then finally, we made it there in March. So I was just so ecstatic. I said to everyone, you know, I won't believe it until I'm actually on the ground in Chile.
It's always the way, isn't it? I've always had a COVID scare just before I'm due to go away somewhere. I just feel like it's sod's law, isn't it, in a way? But yeah, I'm glad you all recovered and you managed to do the trip.
And that's the thing, you know, particularly with the show, everyone, I said to my boss, I'm so sorry. He's like, don't worry about it. You know, everything's getting cancelled. We're so used to this now. The last 2 years, we've just had to roll with it. Things have been postponed, cancelled. You know, prices have gone up, things have changed, things change so drastically, you know, restrictions within countries, it's just madness trying to keep on top of everything.
Oh, I know. I'll be so glad when these restrictions are finished, because trying to write about them every week and keep updated, it's just, oh, I feel like I've swallowed an encyclopedia or the equivalent of the amount of travel restrictions that I've had to write about and are now, you know, glued to my brain. It's just, yeah, it's crazy. I think we're all looking forward to those restrictions easing now. It's the right time, isn't it? A lot of people are being vaccinated and it's great to see that people are getting out in the world again. So have you been able to film at all during the pandemic, or have all of your projects sort of been put on hold?
Yes, well, I was living in Japan. So when we were in Japan, I was there for 8 years, and fortunately, it wasn't too bad. There weren't the harsh lockdowns that you had in the UK. So I was able to travel within Japan relatively freely. And yeah, so we did some great stuff actually during the pandemic within Japan. So that was really fun. I went down to Wakayama it was quite a remote area. It took us best part of a day to get there from Tokyo, and we went on the traditional log rafts in Wakayama, which was great. You know, I poo-pooed that story very early on. I said to the producer, oh, it looks so boring. I really don't want to do this. And I had to eat my words when I got down there. It was actually fantastic. And You know, the editor of the show actually said to me, it was great. It was great that you were able to get out and do something active during the pandemic. So that was great as well. And another funny story we filmed during the pandemic in Tokyo was the Tokyo Horror Drive-Through. So this was born out of the pandemic in Tokyo because people really couldn't go anywhere. And the concept was that in Japan in the summer, ghost stories are a big thing. You know, they're told around the campfires, and that type of atmosphere is created during the summer. So what some ingenious Bright Spark in Tokyo created was this drive-through. So the idea is that you are in your own car, you drive into a random garage in Tokyo, and then they enact a scene for you while you sit in your car with your family or people that you're isolating with. So it was COVID friendly. And the premise was you drive in, they pipe in the audio through your car's system, and it tells you the story. It's a ghost story. You know, you've just arrived home, you've pulled into your garage, and all of a sudden you hear this chain scraping on the ground, and you know, the lights go out, and then all of a sudden someone's tapping at your window and it's a zombie trying to get in your car. It was absolutely terrifying. But That was a really unique story that was born out of the pandemic. It was really, really fun. I was absolutely terrified at the time, but looking back, it was quite a unique and fun piece to do.
It sounds terrifying. I mean, I've done drive-in cinemas, but never drive-in horror stories. And I'm a bit of a scaredy cat. So that would definitely, it was freaking me out just hearing it. But yes, certainly a unique story and a funny one to tell. And your other story as well. It often is, you know, the story that looks a bit dull and boring ends up being actually quite fun and interesting. So yeah really, really pleased you managed to do some of those stories. And Japan sounds like such a fascinating culture anyway. Had a Japan expert on a few weeks back who told me all about the fetish and fantasy dining cafes and all sorts of kooky interesting things that happen in Japan. So yeah, it certainly sounds like an interesting country to create stories in. So obviously when I asked you to come on this podcast, I asked you about some of your highlights, because there are so many stories you've covered over the years, I wouldn't know where to start. And before we get on to those, just tell me a little bit about yourself. When did you first realize you wanted to travel and do this as a line of work? Was it something when you were quite young? Did you travel a lot, or was it, did you sort of just fall into this?
I guess, we traveled quite a lot when I was young, because my mother is from Singapore. I was born in Singapore, and then my dad is from New Zealand, and my grandparents are Scottish. So we did a lot of travel. So, and I was an only child, so I was often unaccompanied on planes going between Singapore and New Zealand, and then we moved to Australia when I was 5 or 6. So would often go backwards and forwards visiting relatives by myself. So that was quite fun back then. You know, you'd sit on the plane with all the other kids, and it was really fun. So I guess traveling has always been a way of life for me, really. Nothing out of the ordinary, something I've always done from a young age.
Fantastic. It's always the way on this show. Quite often people will say, oh, you know, I grew up traveling, or my parents traveled, or, you know, grew up overseas. So yeah, it sounds very exciting. It sounds like you were traveling from a very young age and seeing the world. And speaking of family and roots, and you mentioned your Scottish grandparents there, one of your award-winning stories was when you traced your family tree and discovered that you've got grandparents in Scotland. Tell me a little bit about that, because it didn't all go very well after, did it, if I remember correctly?
No, it went really well after, strangely. So I had always wanted to do this, trace my family tree in Scotland, but back a few generations, there was an illegitimate child. You know, that always makes things difficult when you can't trace mother and father. So I tried myself many years ago and failed miserably. And we were offered this as part of the show because it was the 250th anniversary of the death of Robert Burns. and the Scottish Tourist Board were trying to encourage people from overseas to come and trace their roots. So they said they would help me trace my family tree. So I was like, oh, that's fantastic. So they did. And we found some relatives in Montrose, which was great. We visited some distant relatives. They have a farm, which is just stunning. And yeah, so we went to see local cemetery and things like that. So that was fantastic. You know, I really enjoyed that experience. It was just sad that my grandmother and my dad had already passed, so they couldn't share that experience with me. But yeah, so that was just wonderful to be able to finally trace my family tree, meet some living relatives that I didn't think were still alive in Scotland. So then I, after that story went to air, I moved from the UK to Singapore. And I thought, oh, okay, well, you know, I'm going to try and keep an online CV. So I'll put this story onto YouTube because I don't know when the BBC would remove this story from the server. So I put it on YouTube, and maybe 9 months later, I got a message on Twitter or a message via email through the program saying, oh, I think, you know, I'd like to get in touch with Carmen. I think we have some similar relatives in New Zealand. And I was thinking, oh gosh, you know, I didn't think anything of it really. I just didn't respond. I thought, oh, you know, I don't know. This is a bit crazy. And finally, this person was able to find out my email address, my direct email, and emailed me directly and said, oh, hi, I think we have some similar relatives. And I said, oh gosh. So I forwarded on to my mother and I said, what do you make of this? She's like, don't talk to them until you talk to me. So I was like, you know, I was 36 years of age and I thought, gosh, okay, well. So I spoke to my mother and I said, who is this woman who's trying to contact me? And she said, it's your half sister. So my father had a family before he married my mum, a good 10 years before he married my mum. And so it turned out at the age of 36, I found out that I had a half brother and a half sister in New Zealand. So
no way.
Yeah. So it was something like out of Days of Our Lives. So it was quite a shock, actually. I was, and you know, my mum knew this, but my dad didn't want me to know. I think it's of that generation where they, I don't know, I guess embarrassed, or they, you know, they felt that they hadn't done their best. So they didn't want their kids to know. I don't know. So my dad had died 20 years before. So, and yeah, so I now have a half brother and half sister in New Zealand, which is fantastic. So,
oh, and how did you feel when you found that news out? Did you feel angry at all for not being told, or were you just happy or surprised, or I guess a little bit of everything?
You know what? All the people that, like, my father was no longer around, my grandmother was, people that knew that didn't want me to know were no longer alive. So there was no one really to get mad at. My mum was a bit mortified. I'm sorry I didn't tell you. And, you know, what can you do? So it was fine. And I said to Lynn, my sister, listen, let me just have a few months to get my head around this concept, and then I'll email you. And you know, she said to me, I never thought you'd email me. I never thought you'd email back. And yeah, so I emailed her and I said, right, okay, let's get to know each other. So it's been great. You know, I FaceTime her every month or so. My mum's in touch. When I had my twin boys in Japan, she turned up on my doorstep to surprise me. We went there for Christmas. So yeah, it's been great. It's been a wonderful experience, actually, to have family that I never knew I had, and particularly seeing I grew up as an only child. It's wonderful to know that I've now got a half brother and half sister.
Oh, that's fantastic. And it's just to think, you know, this started off as a bit of a TV assignment, and you thought, oh, that suits me as well. I'd like to trace a family tree, and you got a half brother and half sister out of it. That's fantastic. So nice that you stayed in touch too, because some of these family stories don't always end up so well, do they? So it's nice that you stay in touch, and you know, you've got that extra family now, which is lovely.
Yeah.
So you've done so much throughout your career, Carmen, and you've brought lots of interesting stories to the travel show, some very serious, some a little bit more lighthearted, such as learning to ski on TV, which is not something I'd be brave enough to do. I think I make Bridget Jones look good. So yeah, let's just talk through some of your highlights. I'd love to ask you a bit about North Korea first, because it's such a secretive country. Not many people know anything about it, really. And you had that opportunity to go and film there. So just tell me a bit about the story. What was it? And I imagine the paperwork was a mile long to try and get into North Korea.
It was. So first of all, we went and did the demilitarized zone, which a lot of people can do. It's a place in the border in between North and South Korea where they signed the treaty. So that's quite touristy and people do go and do that. There's bus tours. But then it was quite a unique experience that we were able to jump on board. There was a bus tour that was being organized into Kaesong. So it was the town just over the border. So I think we drove maybe 45 minutes to an hour into the border, into North Korea from Seoul. And it was organized by a company in South Korea trying to help families. I guess it was more aimed at South Koreans looking to go and visit the North, because when the country got divided, it happened quite suddenly. So I think families were separated. So there was a lot of old South Koreans on there looking to see what the North was like, you know, looking to see if they could see some family. Obviously, that wasn't the case. And this tour was very restrictive. So we were on a bus and we're allowed to film. This tour, mind you, I think only lasted maybe 6 months and then they stopped these tours. So I don't think you can do it now, but it was really interesting. So we were only allowed to film a few things. You were able to get on the bus. They took you to a frozen waterfall. We went in January. It was freezing. They had a few sites. So there was a museum with not many artifacts that you could go and see. They took you to a place for lunch, but there was not much to see. And then we were told we weren't allowed to film outside the bus windows, which that was the most interesting part, to see real life North Korean people on the streets. And it was really eye-opening, but of course we couldn't report that and we couldn't film it. We were just allowed to film the certain things on the official tour. And it was January, there was no smoke coming from the houses. So I guess no heating is what I'd gleaned from this. And it was, I think it was like -5. I was freezing cold. And and then they had all these soldiers on the bus and we were given strict instructions. You know, you're not allowed to film from the bus windows. You can't do anything. And, you know, when the people were on the streets, they were being ushered inside by officials. But there were also soldiers on the bus to police this. So to make sure that you didn't use your camera when you weren't supposed to. And through our translator that we had, we were able to, you know, speak to some of these soldiers on the bus. And one of them said, oh, you know, I want to look at your camera. So I showed them my camera and he was looking at all the pictures. And it was just an interesting exchange, because this North Korean soldier showed this photo and looked at this photo on my camera. And he was like, what's this? And I said, it's a Christmas tree. And he didn't know what a Christmas tree was. So we had to explain the concept of Christmas and the Christmas tree to him. And then there was a picture that I'd been surfing for a previous story. I went surfing in China and I had my surfboard. And again, he didn't know what that was. It was just so interesting. So from that perspective, something that we weren't able to officially report on, but just having that interaction with a North Korean person was just really eye-opening.
Yeah, absolutely. And interesting as well, what you saw through the windows as well, because it, like I say, it's so closed off. South Korea, completely different story, but North Korea, so closed off. And it sounds very sad, to be honest, what you're telling me. Do you feel that, you know, what were the people like there? Do you feel like there was a sense of sadness or a sense of missing out or being deprived of stuff? Or do you feel that people there aren't aware of what happens outside of North Korea, like the soldier who didn't know about Christmas or the surfing?
I'm not sure, but I just don't think they realize. And I think it was just genuine curiosity of people on the street seeing these tour buses drive through town, you know, who are they? What are they doing? It was just genuine curiosity. And it was a shame that you couldn't interact with local people. So I don't know. I wasn't able to delve too deeply because we were on a half-day bus tour. But yeah, it was, I felt sad, but I don't think that they necessarily would know too much about what they're missing out on, or maybe they do. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's a difficult one to answer, really, isn't it? But yeah, I think people, they only get, you know, certain things they see on the TV or in the media about North Korea. So it's really interesting. What a privilege to be able to go in and witness a little bit of it on the ground. Fantastic. So did anything surprise you in North Korea at all? Did you go in there with expectations of what it would be like? And did anything surprise you?
I was surprised at the strictness of the tours. And, you know, it was hugely secretive. You know, when we were coming back, we had to get everything x-rayed. All our camera footage was reviewed. I was just a bit shocked at the level of scrutiny that we were subjected to. And I guess I've never been so cold. It was -5 and it was so cold our tripod broke. So, yeah. But I guess what I was acutely aware of was I was not getting the full picture of life in North Korea. It was a very small glimpse.
It's really interesting. And another project which you said was one of your most interesting to cover was, of course, going into Chernobyl, which of course has become something of a bit of a dark tourist destination now, hasn't it? And you went there and filmed. So what was the story for that? Was it just the fact that it was becoming popular with tourists, or was there something else?
Yeah, so we just went in and my cameraman, I remember at the time, he was hugely worried about radioactivity and radiation on his shoes. He insisted on buying a new pair of shoes before we went in. Again, we were there for a day. It was a day trip. We went in, we visited the old school. It was very sad to see kids' toys just left on the floor, school books left as it is. I guess that all happened very quickly as well. And they were evacuated and they were told, oh, you'll be back in a couple of days. So everyone just dropped everything and left. So there was a real sense of abandonment. And that was, it was quite eerie because no one else is there. You're just there. So we didn't go on a bus tour per se. We just went in by ourselves. And that was really, really interesting. And yes, very, very sad and poignant. And interestingly, that was one of the last reports I did before I left London to move to Singapore. And that was due to go to air on the weekend of March 11, 2011. So, of course, that was the huge earthquake and tsunami in Japan. So I remember flying from London to Singapore, and then I got a text message as I landed, oh, we're going to have to pull the Chernobyl piece because there's been a nuclear scare in Japan. So it was deemed insensitive to be running a story about tours through Chernobyl. So yes, it all happened at the same time.
Yeah, gosh, all happening. I can understand why they pulled it though. Absolutely, probably the right thing to do. Disappointing though, when you put the work in. Oh. So how did you feel being inside Chernobyl? Did you feel frightened at all? Were you anxious about the after effects of being there at all? Or were you quite chilled about it? It sounds like your colleague wasn't.
Well, yeah, so the cameraman was very worried. We went in with a Geiger counter as well, and the levels were really low, and they were... And again, we went in February, so there was still snow on the ground. And they say that if there's snow, there's an extra layer of protection, I guess, against any radiation. But with the Geiger counter, there really wasn't any high levels of radiation. So I felt a bit safer than what I thought it would be before I went. So it didn't seem to be a problem. And I haven't had any serious side effects since. So
touch wood.
Yes, touch wood.
Yeah. Well, that's good. And you've come on to the topic of tsunamis already. But another one of your story highlights is reporting from Phuket, which of course is a massive tourism destination in Thailand. I've been there myself. And you went there just after the Boxing Day tsunami, and you were on holiday at the time, weren't you? And you were asked to fly out there. And
yes.
Or actually, you dropped everything on your own accord and flew out there, didn't you, to cover it? So just tell me a bit about that. It must have been really frightening.
Yes. So I was in Singapore for Christmas and I flew to Langkawi just after Christmas on holiday. And so I was a bit apprehensive because Langkawi in Malaysia experienced a bit of destruction, but nothing much. I'm not sure there was too much devastation there. So the resort where I was still open. So we still went on holiday because I called the resort and they were like, oh, please come, you know, people are cancelling. So we were only in Singapore, so we still went. And then the show called me a few days later and said, I don't suppose, what did they say? It was something like, do you think you could voice a track about, you know, something about Thailand? And I said, well, you know, I'm like maybe a 1 hour flight away. So we made some calls and I was able to liaise with the Pacific Asia Travel Association, PATA, and they were hugely helpful. So they were able to help get some flights, to interview someone from their association about the situation there. And they were able to help me with accommodation when we went into Phuket. So that was something that we were able to do at the last minute. And, you know, that was something quite reactionary that we could do for the show that wasn't planned and definitely isn't usually in the remit of the show. So
gosh, yeah.
And on the ground, it was really, really sad. I remember hotel workers were crying on my shoulder. You know, their livelihoods were destroyed. Some had lost family members. And the worst, this is going to sound awful, the worst was the smell. The smell of just, I guess, so many people had died there and everything that had washed up on the beach. It was truly awful. And yeah, and you know, beaches that are usually so full of and jam-packed with tourists that were just deserted. Yeah, that was hugely sad to see firsthand.
Very harrowing. And I guess in a way you must have felt quite helpless. You were there to report it. And you know, with people crying on your shoulder and seeing all of this going on around you,
yeah.
You must have really felt like you just wanted to pitch in and help.
Yeah, it was really crazy. Like I hadn't arrived immediately after. It was a good, you know, 4 or 5 days after the tsunami. But still, you know, the place was just overrun by journalists, which was just awful. And yeah, it was really sad for all the people there. And there just seemed to be so much to do. And, you know, I felt by helping tell their story was going some way to help them. I can't remember at the time what we did to, if there was anything done. I can't remember. It was so long ago. Gosh, how many years ago is that now? 15?
So it's going to be nearly 20 years ago, 18 years ago, something like that.
Yes, wow. Yeah, it was such a long time ago. But yeah, I really did feel helpless at the time. I remember just thinking, oh gosh, you know. And there were tears shed all round, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're seeing, I don't think people think so much about what journalists have to go through to get to these disaster zones. You know, we're seeing it at the moment with people covering what's going on in Ukraine from the ground. You know, when all flights are cancelled, there's no travel there the usual way. You don't often think about how the journalist is actually stood there telling you what's going on. Yeah, was there a lot involved in getting you over there? And how far away were you staying from Phuket?
No, there was no shortage of hotels in Phuket. Some were obviously had damage from the tsunami, but there were still a lot that were just empty. So accommodation wasn't a problem. But also, I guess these war correspondents, this is what they do. They go into war zones and they are, I guess, mentally prepared. I think I went in a bit clueless. That's probably a bit harsh, but you know, I report on travel. I wasn't used to going to a disaster zone. So I think that for me was quite shocking at the time that, oh gosh, you know, these people, they're grieving. There's so much death and destruction around me. It really was a shock.
Absolutely. And have you been back to Phuket since? Have you seen how it's recovered at all?
Yes, I've been back many times. We've been back for holidays. We got married there. But yes, it has really recovered. It's bounced back. It's one of those destinations that is resilient. And the Thai people are so resilient. There's just that fighting spirit.
Absolutely. I mean, I went in, when did I go? Was it 2017 or 2018? A few years ago anyway. And you wouldn't have thought there had been a tsunami there, to be honest. It was great to see it so, you know, busy and back to how it was, which is great. So the last place I'd like to ask you about, or your last project, is filming in Peru. And the reason we're going to talk about this is because you said it was the trip where the most things went wrong. So people don't think about what happens behind the camera, do they? And how these lovely pictures and clips of these exotic places come about. And I'm guessing it's not as glamorous as it seems behind the cameras, particularly when things go wrong. You're laughing there.
Yeah, everything went wrong on this trip, but it was so memorable, you know, that it's always something that I can recount almost blow by blow, because it was such a memorable trip. So it started off really badly that we missed our first connecting flight. So from Lima, we were catching two domestic flights up to the new Machu Picchu in the north. And we missed that first flight. We were sitting at the gate. Don't even ask. It was crazy. We were sitting at the gate, too busy chatting. We'd all just arrived from everywhere. I flew in from Japan. People had flown in from London. And of course, we had our local fixer. And anyway, we were too busy chatting. And they'd closed the gate behind us. And we'd said, oh, you know, sorry. Can we just get on our plane? And this woman was, no. No, you have to catch a bus to get out to that plane. No, we were shocked. And it was truly, truly infuriating, because she then picked up the phone and got them to take our bags off the plane while we could still see it on the tarmac. It was so anyway, this blew out our whole itinerary. So because we missed that first connecting flight. So we had another flight to connect to get up to this hugely remote place in northern Peru. And so then we had to, there were five of us, I think. So two producers, myself, the fixer, and we also had a fireman with us on board, because we had to do an adventure abseil. We were filming down a water, abseiling down a waterfall. So we had the fireman with us.
All the way from the UK?
No. He was a Peruvian fireman. But goodness knows what he thought when all this was kicking off with the bags getting unloaded. So then we had to charter a plane to get us up to this. And it blew the budget as well. So that was...
I was going to say, I'm sure whoever was in charge of the budget wasn't very happy with you.
So that blew the budget from day one. But we made it up there eventually. And then the camera broke. That was, you know, we were driving in cars for half the time. There was a lot of road journeys, like 6-hour car journeys on not very smooth roads, shall we say. And then the drone couldn't get any GPS points. You need a certain amount of GPS points for the drone to fly. And we were halfway down, abseiling down a waterfall, and the drone just lost all coverage.
Oh, no.
So I think we hung for about 30 minutes halfway down a waterfall. So that was fun. That was interesting. I was absolutely terrified to abseil down the waterfall. but by after about half an hour being suspended midair in a gushing waterfall, I think I was over it. I was just like, can we get down now? By which stage the camera batteries had died. Oh, it was a bit disastrous. So so it was a very memorable trip. You know, we overcame all these problems. We were able to fix the camera. The drone got working at some stage. It was, you know, it just makes for a good story. It was a fun trip.
It does. Yeah, it does. It just sounds like one of those things where you're just completely out of sync. You know, you miss one thing and it was just a domino effect then. I can't believe they wouldn't let you on the plane. Surely driving you to the plane was going to be quicker than getting your bags out. But there you go. One of those. Oh, fantastic. And you said it was the alternative Machu Picchu.
Yes, it's called Cuélap. It's near Chachapoyas in the north. It's relatively new because everyone who goes to Peru goes to Machu Picchu, and then this is in the north and it's got lots of historic relevance like Machu Picchu, but it's lesser known. So that's what we were covering up there. It was great, but you know, it was very remote. It became quite, particularly when the camera broke down, you just realized how far away you are from everything. So while all the tourist infrastructure happens down south around Machu Picchu, where we were was super remote.
And is that the kind of stuff you like to cover? Is it stuff that's off the beaten path and remote and unheard of? To me, that's like the ideal story.
Yeah, it is. It's really interesting and totally fascinating to see something new, to be able to say, oh, wow, you know, I've seen this that other people haven't. But at the same time, you know, I haven't been to Machu Picchu. So I've been to Peru, but haven't been to the obvious tourist spot. But no, I wouldn't change it for the world, because it was a fascinating trip and just amazing to say you've been there and experience such fantastic things, you know, that other people wouldn't get to do.
No, it's fantastic. It's a real privilege doing what we do, isn't it? In journalism, travel journalism as a whole. Fantastic. So what, you know, there are some really interesting stories you've mentioned there. How does it get decided what is going to make it onto the BBC travel show?
It's not my decision.
So you're just told where you're going?
Yep, exactly.
Great.
Basically, I'm told where to go and react accordingly. So I don't really have that much of a say in what actually gets to air, unfortunately.
Okay, that's interesting.
So
yeah. But at least, you know, you'll always be surprised, won't you? You won't know where you're going next.
Yes. And I guess part of it is how I react to what we do, whether that gets on air, you know. Yeah. So it's interesting. When we did a food series from Japan, and the premise of the food series was that I lived in Japan and it was to overcome my food fears. So there's a lot of strange food in Japan that, you know, fermented soya beans that people have for breakfast that's hugely sticky and it's really gross. You know, sea urchin and fugu, the puffer fish. So they chose 3-4 foods that I was to try and overcome my food fears. So it was confronting in a way because, you know, they took me on a boat. I had to go and fish for sea urchin and I had to eat it right then and there. We speared this sea urchin. He cracked it open for me. The fisherman cracked it open for me. Here you go. Try this. Oh, my goodness. So you know, I pulled all sorts of faces. Whoa, this is awful. And of course, this is not done on Japanese TV. All Japanese and most food, you know, people don't react so violently to food. Oh, usually people are like, oh, this is delicious. Or this is an interesting taste, where I was off the deep end, like, oh my gosh, I've never tasted anything so disgusting. I don't think I went that far, but there were a few complaints that, you know, that girl, she's, you know, she's reacting so violently. But in a way, you know what, I think I'd prefer to get the complaints and to have a genuine reaction than to be polite and say,
yeah. You know, it's honesty at the end of the day. I wouldn't be offended if a Japanese person came here and hated roast dinners or something and gagged at the thought of them. We're all different, aren't we? We all grew up on different foods. And as much as you like to try the local delicacies, sometimes it's just a no, isn't it? So, yeah, I think my worst fear with that would be actually gagging on camera. I'm starting to sound a little bit like I'm a celebrity now. Yeah, fair play. Brilliant. So you've got to do some really fun things as well as the, you know, the darker things as well, which is great. So I was going to ask you what you've got coming up next, but you don't know, do you?
No, I'm not sure what's happening next. And you know, it took us 2.5 days to get back from Chile, which was less than a week ago, so I'm in no rush to go anywhere.
No, anytime. Put your feet up.
It was crazy. So we left on Tuesday morning. We had a 6-hour car ride to Balmaceda because we were in Patagonia, quite far south. So then we had a 6-hour car drive, which we got a flat tire on the way because the roads are pretty rough. But fortunately, we'd left early. So that we had to change that tire. Then we got to the airport. Then we had another 3-hour flight to Santiago. Then we had to wait around at Santiago Airport and a 12-hour flight to Madrid. And then we had another 4-hour wait at Madrid Airport. And I was asleep on a metal bench, and my producer came and woke me up and said, our flight's been cancelled. So, you know, this was about 9 o'clock at night in Madrid. Oh, so then we had to undergo the process of getting our bags off the plane, getting into an airport hotel, rebooking the flight the next day. It was madness. I think that's my record of the record journey, the journey home. 2.5 days, I think, all in all, that took.
And to think you've been to Australia and it's took you less time.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. I mean, have you even traveled properly if you've not ended up sleeping on a bench in an airport? I don't think so.
That's true. I was one of those people. I said, oh gosh, you know, oh, I'm going to, should I sleep on the floor? I slept on the bench. But yes,
yeah,
that was.
And what was the story anyway? What was the story you're covering? Are you allowed to say, or?
Yes, we were doing a story. There were a few stories we did in Chile. One was about water in the desert, the relationship with water and people and tourism in the desert, in the Atacama Desert. So that was really interesting. We also did a story about the mummies, the Chilean mummies that are actually older than the Egyptian mummies by a few thousand years, and which I think is hugely interesting, but people don't know about this yet. And we could actually see some mummies in situ in the ground, in the desert in Chile, as well as in the museums. And then we went down south to Patagonia to look at the route of parks. So what they've done down in Patagonia, Doug and Christine Tompkins from the Tompkins Foundation, many years ago, more than 30 years ago, bought up a lot of land in Chile. And they have now given it back to the government on the proviso that they keep it as a national park. So it's now got national park designation. And so this has, in effect, preserved large swathes of land. I think, I can't remember the stats, but it's huge. Like there are 17 national parks all linked together, and it's called the Route of Parks. And we only saw the very tip of it, but it's truly amazing. And the wildlife that's there, it's just staggering that, you know, so many years ago that they, Doug and Christine, had bought this land, and now they've given it back, and Chile has this amazing, pristine national park that is now can be a big tourist draw for them. It was amazing. We went deer tracking. We saw some Waimul deers that, you know, it's quite an old-fashioned tracking device. We went around with a man with what looked like an 80s television antenna who had collars on a few deers around the park, and he was able to find the deer with their radio frequencies on the collars. So we were able to get really close to these deer. And then there was all sorts of wildlife that was there. It was truly amazing. And there were these wanakos. They look a bit like a cross between a deer and a llama. And they were all by the roadside. It was just amazing to see such wildlife. And we went and saw what looks like a ostrich. It's called a nyandu. And again, we were able to get super close. And it was one of those trips that was just fascinating. And I can't believe we actually did it.
You made it. It took 2 days to get home, but it certainly sounds worth it.
It was definitely worth it.
Yeah. So, and I'll be keeping a lookout for it on the travel show when it comes out, because it sounds very fascinating.
It will be coming out very soon.
Amazing. Well, my last question for you, Carmen, is, are there any destinations that you would love to film in? Do you have a dream destination or story, or are you happy just to see where life and the producers take you?
No, there's so many places I still want to go. There's lots of places on my list. You know, I think I've been to more than 80 countries. I've stopped counting now. There was a time where I was quite religious in my counting. And there's still lots of Africa that I haven't seen. You know, I remember I was on the verge of booking a trip to Libya many years ago. But now, of course, that's off the cards. So, you know, lots of places that I haven't been to that I would love to go to. Costa Rica, Africa. I'd love to go to Zambia and Zimbabwe, Namibia. Nepal. I still haven't done Nepal. I've done most of Asia. But there's still lots of places I would love to go to.
It's funny, isn't it? It's very cliche, but it's the more you see, the more you want to see, I find, particularly in this job, when you're writing about travel, you think, oh, I want to go there. I'm going to add that to my list. And it's great. But I'm actually, funnily enough, going to Peru in June and doing the Inca Trail to Machu Picchu. So we'll have to compare notes.
Great. Yes. Oh, the food is good in Peru.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Ceviche.
Good ceviche.
I refuse to eat guinea pig, though, because I had pet guinea pigs when I was little, and I just feel like I was eating my pet. So that's a delicacy await me trying, but I'm sure there are plenty of other lovely dishes to try.
I avoided the guinea pig as well.
Yes. Well, it's been lovely talking to you, Carmen. Thank you so much for coming on and telling us about some of your interesting adventures. And we'll look out for your next piece on Chile on the Travel Show.
Thanks so much, Laura.